How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Did you have a great Halloween?
I did. I just love everything. I love the weather. I love the trees. I like the crisp, cool air. I just love it. I do.
I know. I was kind of sad, though. We normally get 300 kids, if not more. I mean, our subdivision's usually packed with kids.
Mm-hmm.
This year, I bet you we didn't even get 100.
It's because it's growing up.
Well, I think it was Sunday night and a lot of people were at church, maybe, and they did trunk or treats and all that kind of stuff.
You know what? That's right. A big thing now is they do it on Saturday night if it's on the weekend so that the parents can sleep late, which is, I get it.
Yeah, that's fine. It works. It works. But yeah, it was just kind of sad. The cutest costume I saw was a little boy who was probably 2 and he was in a pterodactyl costume.
Rawr.
And I asked him if he could fly. And so every time we saw him in the neighborhood, he'd be going, fly. It was really
cute.
I love it. All right. Well, I've got a case. You want to listen to it?
I cannot wait.
Today's episode is actually a listener suggestion, and the person suggested this a while ago, and for some reason, I didn't write down who suggested it. So, if it's you, come forward, let us know. I don't know why I didn't do it. We still love you, and I'm sorry I didn't write your name down.
Probably if you looked back through the things, you could find it. But
I'm sure I could find it. I just didn't.
It's okay. It's okay.
I apologize. So, you can come forward if you did suggest that. Anyway. Today, we are going to the St. George area of Bristol in England. Thursday, February 19th, 2015. The day started out like any other day. Dad, Darren Galsworthy, left early for work. His wife, Angie, who suffers from MS or multiple sclerosis, was getting ready for a doctor's appointment when 16-year-old daughter Becky knocked on the door, the front door. She was coming home from spending the night at a friend's house. She was having problems with her key. Her key wasn't turning in the lock. Now, technically, Becky was Darren's daughter. Darren and Angie had both had children from prior relationships. Danny and Becky Watts were Darren's. Angie had a son by the name of Nathan Matthews. And blended families are pretty much the norm these days. Danny was 6 and Becky was 3 when the couple moved in together. 14-year-old Nathan wasn't really thrilled that Becky would be living with his mother full time because, quote, she was loud and annoying. And honestly, my brother thought the same thing about me.
I think that's pretty normal.
But you know what? He was living with his grandmother, but usually he stayed the weekends with Darren and Angie. And he lived with his grandmother because Angie was in a horrible relationship and she thought Nathan would have a better, stable life with his grandmother. And then once the relationship got better, she felt horrible putting him in a new school. And you know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
She just kept him where he was at. Becky was so tiny when the two moved in together that she pretty much thought of Angie as her mother instead of her stepmother. In fact, as a young girl, she would always say that she was lucky because she had two mothers. Her and Angie were just super duper close. Becky, like most teens, once she got in from her friend staying the night, she went straight up to her bedroom, up the stairs, and she was listening to music and was texting her boyfriend. Angie then went off to a doctor's appointment. Just after 11 a.m., Becky gets a text from her boyfriend, Luke, saying that he was going to go to the dentist's office, and Becky replied, Goody XXXX with a heart and kiss blowing emoji. They were to see each other after his appointment and hang out. They were on school half term on break, so they were having a good time doing everything but schoolwork.
Amen.
At 12:09, Luke texts Becky and says, "I'm done at the dentist office," smiley face, kissing heart. And he never hears back from her. Angie gets home from her doctor's appointment at around 12:45. She sees that her son, Nathan, who's 28 now, and his girlfriend, Shauna Hoare. Yes, correct. I know. It's a horrible name.
How do you spell that?
H-O-A-R-E. Sometimes she went by the name Phillips.
Okay.
She was 21. They were at the house watching TV, playing on their phone, and not really a big deal that they were there. Shauna helps care for Angie. She's kind of like a registered caregiver for Angie, since Angie suffers from MS. They actually got in the house because Angie kept a key under one of the trash cans outside for them to use. And just like any mother, you can always tell if something, the child's not in the house. And she asked, you know, where did Becky go? Where's Becky? And when Angie asked, you know, where's Becky, Shauna said that she was outside smoking when she heard the front door slam shut. So Becky must have left the house. A few hours later, Luke, Becky's boyfriend, was knocked at the front door. He was looking for Becky. She hadn't answered any of his texts. And that wasn't like her at all. So Angie went upstairs just to check to make sure Becky wasn't there, and she wasn't. And she, you know, promised Luke that I'm sure everything's okay. And that as soon as Becky came home, she would have her call him. Becky didn't make it home for dinner either. And, you know, the family wasn't worried because Becky was a good kid. I mean, she was your typical girl who loved animals, music, makeup, fashion. Her grandma described her as a tornado, hurricane, and sunbeam all wrapped into one.
Oh, that's cute. I like it.
She was painfully shy. She was anxious, and she was quiet around everybody other than her close friends and family. Like her dad said, she was so shy, she wouldn't go onto a bus alone because she was afraid to ask for a ticket. And the poor girl, she, when she was younger, she was a bit chubbier. Just baby fat, though, nothing big. I mean, nothing out of the ordinary, but she had been bullied so badly about her weight when she was young, it led to her becoming anorexic. But Becky recovered. And I mean, at one point, the poor little girl had lost over 80 pounds. And she was just a tiny thing anyway. She was only like 5'1", very tiny, very petite. Now, Becky's parents didn't really get worried until the next afternoon when Becky's friends all showed up to the house. They were concerned because Becky hadn't returned anybody's calls or text. And in fact, all of the calls were going to voicemail, like the phone was either dead or had been shut off. Darren came home from work when he heard the news, and he took one of Becky's friends up into her room to see if anything was missing. They found Becky's blue puffer jacket, her phone, her tablet, and her laptop were missing, which was odd because Becky never took her computer anywhere. They also noticed that Becky's makeup and purses were still there, and she never left without any of those. They called Becky's biological mother and her brother Danny just to see if they had seen Becky, and they hadn't. So everybody was really getting nervous again. So they sat down and they started talking. Who was the last one to actually see, actually lay eyes on Becky? And it turned out it was Angie. Angie's the one that last saw Becky, and it was at 8:30 in the morning the previous day when she came home from spending the night at her friend's house. So, of course, Darren immediately calls the police to report her missing. And the police, it's a teen. You know how they kind of are kind of weird.
Flighty.
The police suggested that, you know what, Becky is probably at a friend's house, right?
They always do that.
I know. And Darren replied, quote, "She doesn't have many friends, and the ones she has are sitting on my sofa right now. She's either with her friends, at school, or home with us." Darren then set out on foot, knocking on neighbors' doors, asking anyone he saw if they had seen Becky. And no one had. When he got back to the house, Nathan and Shauna were there with their young child, and he asked Nathan to help him put something about Becky missing on Facebook. Nathan found a picture of Becky and they wrote a post which said, "Please share. Missing 16-year-old girl. Please private message if you've seen her or know anything." And within hours, the post had been shared by friends close to 900 times.
Wow.
Around 6 p.m. that evening, two police officers arrive and they interview the family. Darren explains that he was at work. Angie tells that she was at her doctor's appointment and she came home at 12:45. And how Nathan and Shauna said that they had been at that house that day and they had heard music coming from Becky's room. Then the music went off and Shauna heard the door slam, but didn't technically see Becky leave. They told the police that there'd been no arguments and Becky had been in a great mood. They didn't know what she'd just disappeared.
Why is she slamming the door? She getting a fight with somebody?
Oh, Shauna's a piece of shit. Shauna was telling, and I didn't add this and I should have, but Shauna was like, oh, she was in a mood. She throws temper tantrums. She was like, blah, blah, blah.
She's not in a mood. She's a kid.
She's a teenager. On Saturday, 2 days after Becky had gone missing, 8 police officers arrived to the house just to search for clues and to take DNA samples. Hundreds of police in 2 separate counties will search for Becky. People will put out missing posters. They'll be handing them out. They'll be posted everywhere. Media and newspapers and TVs ran stories on Becky, and on all social media, the hashtag #FindBecky had been shared over 2 million times. I mean, this was no small effort to find this poor 16-year-old girl. Darren and Becky's grandmother, Pat, held a press conference where they begged for Becky to come home. Darren said, quote, "Becky, we just want you to come home. You're in no trouble at all. We just want to make sure you're okay. If you can, please give us a call or a text. Just let us know you're safe. We all love you and want you back home with us." And then, oh my God, this press conference, you can find it on YouTube and I'll post a link. He just breaks down in tears.
That's so sad.
Heart-wrenching. Just heart-wrenching. And then Grandma Pat added, quote, "Becky, we love you so much. We all love you and we want you back home with us. You are so loved. I don't think you realize just how much. You can come and stay at mine for as long as you need. If you are Becky's friend and you are sheltering her, you are not doing right by Becky. Just please get in touch." But with all the searching and all the pleas for any information of the whereabouts of Becky, there was nothing. There was no clues. There was no sightings of Becky. And you know how in all of England, there are so many CCTV cameras and footage. There's nothing. She showed up on nothing. No footage of her at all. And it just seemed that she simply vanished into thin air. She was gone. By the following Wednesday, there was still no sign of Becky. The police decided to bring in a forensic team just to scour the house for any clues. I mean, they even brought sniffer dogs in. It was so in-depth that Darren and Angie had to leave the house. They couldn't stay there. They were put up in a hotel. That day, on that Wednesday, over 100 friends and family gathered to search for Becky as police then turned their search to a pond that was at St. George Park. The police tried to get in touch with stepbrother Nathan and his girlfriend Shauna for a more formal interview down at the station. They were having problems tracking them down. They couldn't find them. And because they were having such a hard time, police were going suspicious of the two. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that they were going to see Shauna's mother, who Shauna hadn't seen for years.
Oh. Years. Just had a sudden urge to see her, I guess?
Yeah, just knock on the door. And in fact, we'll find later that the mother had mentioned something about, oh, do you guys know where Becky's body is? Yeah. Huh. So anyway, finally, the police were able to get them in for an interview. And they interview them separately. Shauna, the whole time, has this odd smile, almost a smirk on her face as she speaks with police. She even laughs, or as the media called it, she was giggling when she was asked all these questions.
Why? Did she like the attention?
It could be nervousness, maybe.
Yeah, but
I don't know. The police didn't.
Exactly. Necessarily.
Mm-hmm. If your sister-in-law was missing for over a week, you don't think you'd be laughing. You wouldn't be missing either, would you? Would you be out looking for your sister-in-law?
You'd think so, yep.
You would think I would be. I don't know about anybody else. But anyway, one of the things Shauna mentioned about Becky was that she thought Becky was pretty disrespectful to Angie. And she also thought that Becky had used her anorexia to manipulate people. And she felt that it was more of a attention thing rather than a real eating disorder.
Uh-huh.
And Nathan, he seemed really relaxed. He didn't seem concerned that his younger stepsister had disappeared at all. He was 11 years older than Becky. But he just was kind of nonchalant. He even kind of cracked jokes a little bit too. And the two seemed to have their accounts of the day. Their accounts fit together perfectly. And usually when witnesses, they don't have perfect versions of what happened. And especially two people, it doesn't line up like a puzzle piece, right? And that's what these two, it seemed like.
Perfect.
Their things were perfectly
matched
up. Maybe
even rehearsed.
Possibly rehearsed is what the police were thinking, yes.
Huh. Hmm.
So they decided to go a different route, and they asked Shauna how Nathan was handling Becky's disappearance, and she said, oh, he's been so upset. And not just because Becky's gone, but Nathan really hated to see his mom so upset, because he loves his mom so much. But then when the police asked about Nathan's relationship with Becky, Becky said that the two really didn't talk very much and he didn't particularly like her. And in fact, it annoys him how she speaks to his mother sometimes. Sometimes she is just rude to her. He describes Becky as selfish, self-centered, and spoiled.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. She's 16.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Police asked Darren and Angie in for another interview, too, and they put the Angie and Darren in separate rooms, and they start asking them questions about the family dynamic, like, does Becky get along with Nathan and Shauna? All those kind of things. And they really didn't. I mean, it was kind of a stressful relationship, but nothing that anybody was concerned about. It would be like me dealing, they're siblings, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they all fight.
So come to find out, forensics, while scouring the house, did uncover some very minute blood spatter on the door frame of Becky's room. It was so small that it could barely be seen by the naked eye. And it was like close to the floor, in the middle of the door frame, and then like shoulder high, you know, it was that kind of blood spatter. Very thin, misty blood spatter.
Mm-hmm.
And inside, some of those tiny little drops of blood were fingerprints.
Oh.
It took 12 hours, and the police knew that the blood was Becky's, and the prints belonged to Nathan. Now, at this point, the police are still hoping that Becky is alive, but they do arrest Nathan and Shauna for kidnapping. And there's a video of the two getting arrested. They're calm. Now, if I was being arrested for kidnapping, and I was innocent, I'd, no.
But of These course, two, because if you've done, anybody that would be arrested, having no idea why they are being arrested, mm-hmm. would freak out. Now, if you kind of suspect it's coming at any minute,
Yeah. Shauna, in fact, is kind of laughing, you know, about the whole thing. And yeah, they're just calm, weird. And Darren and Angie, of course, are shocked. They can't believe that Angie's son and his girlfriend, wife, whatever, would have anything to do with Becky's disappearance. They didn't understand. They're like, there's no way. You're wrong. So with the two under arrest, police search Shauna and Nathan's home. Now, opening the front door proved to be very difficult. It seemed to say the house was messy is an understatement. It was a house of a hoarder. Junk was stacked everywhere. And I'm not talking clutter either. I mean, this thing is jam-packed with crap. Old computers, microwaves, refrigerators on top of freezers. Just, there was a mattress propped up in the hallway. It was gross. And supposedly it smelled like cat litter, crap. It's nasty.
Hoarder.
You could barely walk in the house. There's dirty dishes piled all over the sink and the counter. There's trash bags everywhere. There's stuff on the stove. In fact, I think the only clear place was like the bedroom, and they had like a little toaster oven so they could cook there. I mean, it was disgusting. When you look at it, it's bad. It made me feel better about my house, but it was bad. And they had a little kid, too. That's
happens all the time, my friend.
I know. And anyway, I'm back to this. Police go upstairs and they see a bathroom and they walk in. Bathroom piled high with crap, so high that they couldn't even see that there was a sink. There's just so many things piled in. But on the other side of the bathroom was a sparkling clean bathtub. Like so sparkling clean, so spotless, you could probably see your own reflection in it.
Well, that's odd. I wonder what
Very
happened
strange.
There.
Very strange. Mm-hmm. And one of the police that was interviewed said, you know, that's the part where we're like, oh, okay, this isn't going to be good.
Mm-mm.
Police spent 2 days searching the house. They found a receipt for a circular saw, safety goggles, gloves, and masks purchased on the Friday after Becky went missing. There's also rolled up receipts for cleaning products, cling film, like Saran wrap here in the States, bags and tape, 2 stun guns, one that had the word police written down the side, and we'll find out later that Shauna had ordered those in January.
Mm.
They also found a Toshiba laptop that had a 17-minute clip entitled, Virgin Teen Gets Raped in Her Own House, plus 236 images and 21 films relating to teenagers in porn. Becky's not one of them, by the way. So checking the CCTV from the stores where the receipts were from, they could see Nathan purchasing the circular saw and another video which showed Nathan and Shauna purchasing the cleaning supplies, tape, trash bags, and cling film. Police, with this information, they go back to Nathan and they don't really say that they have evidence on him that they found anything, but they hinted that they did. And for some reason, this makes him crack. And at 10:26 p.m. on March 1st, Nathan confessed to the murder of his stepsister, Becky, by writing a statement with his lawyer. The police, you could see the video of it. He's a strange adult. He's 28. But the police is like, okay, we're going to read you this, your confession back to you. And he's like, okay, do I have to listen to it? And he like puts his head down and he puts his fingers in his ears. And then he like bawls. He just starts crying. Police go to Shauna and tell her that Nathan had confessed, and she just nods, and she said she finds him sick and disgusting, and she claims that she had no idea what had gone on.
Nothing. Not at all.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nope. And they asked her if she knew Becky was dead, and she goes, oh, I've only, just when you told me that she was murdered by Nathan, that's the first time I've heard of it. When she asked, though, if she had any involvement, she said that she didn't, and there was no proof that she did. Then the police started bringing evidence, what they had on her, and she went quiet and started to do that whole no comment thing.
Yeah.
What police had done is they had gone through Shauna and Nathan's phone records. And on the evening Becky was killed, Shauna's mobile phone was used to search YouTube for a video called Do You Want to Hide a Body? A parody of Do You Want to Build a Snowman?
I knew you were going to say that.
Disney's film Frozen.
Mm-hmm.
They also were able to get deleted texts between the two where they spoke about kidnapping young petite girls to have sex with. Not to mention all the pornography that they had with the teenagers and young women dressed as schoolgirls. Some of them had threesomes. You know, like I said, let's not forget about the laptop with the 17-minute video. But yeah, every time they'd mention something like that, she'd go, no comment, no comment. But it was pretty obvious that Nathan was addicted to pornography, and she kind of helped feed that addiction. The following morning, the police knocked on the hotel door where Darren and Angie stayed while the forensics had searched their house. They were then informed by the police that they arrested Nathan and Shauna again, but this time for murder charges. Actually, Nathan had murder charges, and Shauna was arrested on a charge of perverting justice. Later, Shauna will be charged for murder too, but we'll just get that. Darren and Angie are also told that they believe Becky's murder was sexually motivated.
Disgusting.
Then they explain that Becky's dismembered body was found about 2 miles from their house, and it was in a shed that was owned by a man by the name of Carl Demetrius, who was a friend of Nathan's. Carl and his wife, Jadeen Parsons, were arrested and charged with assisting an offender. They insisted they didn't know anything. They didn't know what was in the bags that they were storing for them. They would go to trial and they both would serve a little time, but it was just for perverting justice. They actually did not know what was in there.
Susan Eads, Jody Loomis, Jessica Baggin, Christy Mirak, Gwen Miller. What do all these women have in common? They are all murder victims whose cases went cold for decades until they were finally solved thanks to a new crime-solving technique that is changing the game, forensic genealogy. But who were these women? Why did their homicide cases remain open and unsolved for so long? Who were their killers? And what was the link between each victim and her murderer? DNA ID sets out to answer these questions. My podcast looks at the original crime, the investigative work on the case, red herrings, potential suspects, and the evidence left behind by the killer. And it then examines how each case was solved by forensic genealogy and the connection that led to the fateful interaction between victim and murderer. In many cases, I speak to the detectives who cracked the case, and they give me insight into their methods, theories, and what went on behind the scenes. Join me every other Monday for a new episode. Be sure to subscribe to DNA ID wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode.
Police identified Becky's body using the DNA sample from her toothbrush that they had gathered when she at first went missing. Later, a postmortem would show that the cause of death was suffocation. Angie had actually asked to see Nathan while he was in prison because she wanted to look him in the eye and make him tell her everything, but his lawyer wouldn't allow it. On Sunday, March 8th, a family member who wanted to remain anonymous organized a balloon release memorial for Becky at St. George's Park. It was one of her favorite places to be. More than 400 people had shown up and each held a helium-filled balloon. And from the book, From Evil Within, written by Darren Galsworthy, which I got a lot of this information from, he writes of the moment, quote, "We all stayed silent as we lifted our balloons up in the air and let them go. It felt as if I was letting go of Becky in that moment. The crowd gave a small cheer, but I couldn't help bursting into tears as I watched the balloons float away. The sky was filled with different colors and shapes, and it was beautiful. I knew Becky would have been delighted by it, and I hoped that somehow she could see them." Becky's funeral was in mid-April. Over 200 people watched Becky's funeral procession. They all held pink flowers as four white horses wearing pink feathers pulled a white carriage containing Becky's coffin. Pink and blue were Becky's favorite colors, so pink roses tied with blue ribbons decorated Becky's white coffin. Friends and family wanted her funeral to be fit for a princess, and it really was.
Good. She did.
If it wasn't so horribly sad to see the coffin inside, you would have thought that a princess was coming. I mean, it was just very royal. When the funeral was over, the family walked out of the church to the song Somewhere from West Side Story that Becky's grandfather, Darren's dad, had recorded. Oh my God, when I first read this, I started crying because that song is like, it's a very emotional song for me. I'm surprised I'm not crying now, but anyway. And before Becky's coffin was put back into the carriage to go to the interment, Darren, Becky's father, released a white dove. Nathan Matthews and Shauna Hoare's trial started on October 6, 2015. No matter how ready Becky's family was for this to be over with, nothing prepared them for the horror that they would hear. Nathan's taped confession was played before the court, and Nathan said that he decided to kidnap Becky because he felt she wasn't appreciative of his mother, Angie. He told the interviewers, quote, "The main problem was that Becky would leave things on the stairs or in the kitchen or in places where Mom would walk. My mom could have fallen over and been seriously injured. And she talked to my mom like dirt. She used to swear at her. I was just going to scare Becky." Nathan had brought a kidnap kit, which was a large bag, a stun device, handcuffs, tape, and a mask. A stun gun, basically. He planned to get her in the suitcase, put her in the car, and then drive somewhere where he would tie her to a tree and tell her she needed to change her ways and treat people better.
Mm.
And then he was just going to let her go.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way she would ever tell anybody
anything,
and it'd just be fine and she'd be better.
How many of these killers say that they, you know, they didn't mean it, they were just trying to scare him?
Yeah.
You hear that a lot.
He's frustrating. So on the morning of the 19th of February, Nathan put on a mask and knocked on Becky's door. And as soon as she opened the door, he put tape over Becky's mouth. And then he made his voice lower. And Nathan said something to the effect of, "As long as you do what you're told, you're going to be fine." At that point, Becky got down on her knees and Nathan put Becky's hands behind her back and then he handcuffed her. And as he was getting her into the suitcase, he claimed his mask slipped off. And he got scared, so he quickly put his hands over her eyes, took off his mask completely, and just taped her eyes shut. Because he was afraid she's going to know it was him, which, no, you know what? She probably already did. I mean, Becky's no dummy. You can lower your...
If I lower my voice like this, you'd still know it was me, right?
Yes, of course.
As he was trying to get her into the suitcase, she started to resist and try to get away. And that's when he pinched her nose shut so she couldn't breathe. He had hoped she'd just pass out. But again, he tried to get her into the suitcase. And he told her not to struggle and you'll be released unharmed. But she still refused to do what he said.
Because
she was fighting him.
He's just scaring her.
Right? I know. And then Nathan said he remembered punching Becky. And then said, quote, "The last thing I did was try to make her pass out, which is something we did at school. It's like strangling, but it doesn't completely restrict the air.
Oh.
People at school would pass out. Some would take a minute. Some would take 15 or 20 seconds at a guess. After that, she stopped kicking. I moved her head and tried to position her in the suitcase. Then I picked up the other bits. Something didn't seem right with her breathing. I checked for a pulse, and she didn't have one." Now, this is when he says he panics, because he didn't want anybody to know what happened. You think? So he went, and he got Becky's phone, laptop, her tablet, some makeup, some clothes, and he threw them all in, you know, the suitcase, just to make it look like she had gone off somewhere, or she just left. He also said he used a stun gun on Becky, but it didn't work. Now, this is what I don't understand. Maybe for some reason I got it out of context or out of order. But if she wasn't breathing, why would he use a stun gun? Was he trying to get her to jump to make
maybe to
her,
come to?
Yeah.
Either come to or in his head, make her
shock her, make her heart.
Yeah.
Chuck in, maybe.
Or make her, if she was just passed out, maybe make sure, who knows, make sure she's really dead to
maybe,
check her to
know.
See if she came to after that.
I don't know. Then said he took off the handcuffs, put them in the suitcase, and then he put the whole thing in the trunk of his car. And then tried to act like nothing had happened in front of Shauna. Which, you know, Shauna and Nathan stayed the rest of that day with Darren and Angie. Like, they had dinner with them, they watched TV.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't leave till 7 p.m., and, like, nobody suspected anything was wrong.
Mm-mm.
Right?
No, not at all.
He then said, quote, "I didn't tell Shauna. I wanted to hide it from her. The suitcase stayed in the car. Sometime that night or in the early hours of the morning, I decided to dismember Becky's body. I bought drain cleaner to dissolve the body, but that didn't work." So when police tried to ask Nathan when he thought what he was thinking as he cut up Becky's body, he said, quote, "I just did it. I tried not to look. I did it like it was just surreal. And that's the only way I can explain it, and just doing what I had to do to protect everybody else, stop them from finding out that she's gone." He then said that he offered Carl Demetrius £10,000 from the money he and Shauna had had in their savings account just to help him move and store the items. Thing was, they couldn't look inside the boxes at all. And one of them thought that the boxes had something to do with a robbery.
Robbery of a life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Detective Sergeant John Dowding took the stand and talked about finding Becky in the shed. Quote, "The officer and I had opened the large case nearest the door and found a number of items inside. They appeared to be parcels of cling film with plastic bags, and the bags had numerous parcels inside. I pulled out one of the smaller parcels, about the size of a rugby ball, to see what the item was. I examined the parcel by feeling it. I tried squeezing and manipulating it to see what was inside. It was squashy. Yeah. But there was something harder within the squashy material. We tried unwrapping the parcel to confirm what the contents were. After two or three layers of cling film, it was apparent that it was a right hand, and the fist was clenched and severed at the wrist.
That's awful.
Police also found bloodstained goggles, a knife, masks, and handcuffs. They also found the circular saw used to cut up the body. And I just want to add that one of the masks had makeup stains and Shauna's DNA. So there's your proof, Shauna. There's your proof.
Mm.
Pathologist Dr. Deborah Cook told the court that Becky had had 14 cuts and bruises to her face, which was consistent of a hand being placed over her face to suffocate her. There was also 15 stab wounds to her stomach that had been made post-mortem. She also spoke of inside a blue plastic bin underneath several layers of clothes, plastic bags, and cling film. Dr. Cook said that she found a plastic sack that said, "It's my birthday, Wacky Warehouse." Then a white shower curtain, and underneath that, a human torso. In a suitcase, the pathologist found Becky's left arm, right hand, right leg, and her head. She said, quote, "The outside packaging was an Asda carrier bag." Asda is a grocery store, I believe. "Inside that was cling film, and then inside that was duct tape and further wraps of cling film and thick blue plastic wrapped in silver duct tape. The head was inside the plastic bag, and there was clear tape over the face, and the head was covered in damp white crystals. Some of the body parts were packed with cat litter and table salt, which acts as a preservative and probably keeps the smell down a bit, I would think. The body was dismembered with a circular power saw in 8 different locations. And the expert said that it would have been easier to carry out that dismemberment if more than one person was involved, that it would be quite hard to do it with one person with a circular saw. The court also heard how Nathan was mean and abusive to Shauna. A friend of the couple said that she thought Nathan was controlling and didn't like Shauna to go out without him. The witness said that he could be very paranoid and he got jealous if Shauna spoke to other men. She also added that Nathan had told her that he hated Becky, saying that she was spoiled and selfish. They were trying to prove that Shauna was fearful of Nathan and that she would do anything that Nathan said. But I don't believe it's true, because the way Shauna handled herself in the police interview, she was a smart one. She's the one that never cracked.
Mm-hmm.
Nathan's the one that was crying mess and would rock back and forth. And I mean, Shauna's expression really didn't change that much. Prosecutors also played a clip in court of an interview with one of Becky's friends. And she said that Nathan had repeatedly told Becky that he would kill her for years before he actually did. And sometimes he even told her, he even went into graphic detail about how he planned to kill her. Once again, the court's trying to make you feel sorry for Shauna. And they said how Shauna had grown up in foster care. She had moved to Bristol to be with her mom when she was 13. She was like one of 9 kids, 8 kids.
Still doesn't make you a killer.
Mm-mm. She said Nathan was very controlling. She claimed that he once tried to strangle her. And once during a fight, he stabbed himself in the face with a fork. Just, she was trying anything she could, you know. She was so guilty. Anyway. And I also want to mention, she started seeing Nathan when she was 14 years old.
Oh,
he was 21. He likes those young girls. No. And in the book Evil Within, Darren was saying that he didn't really care for Shauna when he first met her. And then after a while, you know, she became okay. And then, of course, after she had their first grandbaby and she started working with Angie when Angie was sick. But no. And he really didn't like that Nathan was 21 seeing a 14-year-old.
It's kind of gross.
It's
not kind of gross. It's very gross. Mm-hmm. I was trying to be nice.
But when Shauna was on the stand and she was asked, you know, your husband was in the bathroom in your house cutting up a body, right? Didn't you hear anything? And she said she did hear something, but he had told her that the toilet was backed up and broken. And so he was in there fixing the pipe. She just believed that that's what he was doing. He was in there fixing the pipe to fix the broken toilet because it was blocked. And she, on the stand, was denied every chance. She did not know anything about Becky's death. She was not involved in Becky's death. Nothing. When the prosecutor asked Shauna, is it just an unhappy coincidence that you and Nathan were talking about kidnapping a teenage girl? She kind of nodded and said, yeah, it was. And he's like, well, what about when you played him that YouTube video? Do you want to hide a body? On the day Becky died. And she said that she only played it to make him laugh.
Because that's funny.
Yep, it was just a coincidence. The prosecutor.
Wait, when I say funny, not funny at all.
It's not funny at all.
I just want to clarify that I meant funny like she was trying to pass that off that she thought it was funny and he'd think it was funny. It's not funny.
The prosecutor was a man by the name of William Mousley. And he's like, oh, so it's just a coincidence that Becky was lying dead in the bath a few feet away. And she's like, yeah, it was a coincidence.
Come on.
So actually, the prosecutor, William Mousley, described Shauna to the jury as Lady Macbeth, quoting, be like an innocent flower, but a serpent beneath it.
Underneath it. Yes.
On Wednesday, the 11th of November, 2015, after a whole 3.5 hours of deliberation, the jury returned a verdict. They found Nathan guilty of murder. They gave him a life sentence with a chance for parole after 33 years. Shauna was found not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter and given a sentence of 17 years.
What?
Mm-hmm. And you guys will all be happy to know that the two don't seem to be doing very well in prison. A friend of Shauna's claimed that Shauna had been attacked and beaten so severely when she's serving her time that she had to be resuscitated twice.
Really?
And, well, when a spokesperson was for the prison where she's serving her sentence out has said that they are not aware of any incidents and, quote, these allegations are completely untrue. So we're not for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Nathan, Nathan had a jug of boiling butter poured over his face and neck.
I saw that in the, what movie was that? Yeah. You this heat inmate, up oil, baby oil.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's bad news. Put by an inmate that has hated him for a long time, is what it said. Staff in the prison doused him with water, and he was taken to the hospital, but he has since recovered. And when Darren, God love him, Becky's dad, was told about the incident, he said, karma's a bitch. I'm not sorry it happened. And by the way, it's my birthday today, and it's the best present I'll get. This made my day. And, quote, are the injuries life-threatening? Because I won't truly be happy until Nathan is dead.
Wow.
And believe it or not, Darren and Angie are still together. They are still as strong as ever. And yeah.
Well, I think those horrific things that happen, they either pull you apart or bring you closer. And it just all depends.
Really hard to still stay with a partner whose child killed your child.
I think it would be. Yes.
And not by accident. Couldn't imagine. I mean, a lot of couples don't stay together after a child dies of sickness, of illness, right?
Well, that's what I mean. You get pulled together, but you know, maybe they always knew something was wrong with Nathan.
Yeah, I don't. They all seem to get feeling, I don't know, just shocking. Mm-hmm. Just completely shocking, this whole thing. I would strongly suggest there's a couple documentaries to watch. There's a bunch of police interviews that you can watch when they're interviewing Nathan. Like, just, there's something not right with him.
He's missing something.
Yeah, like the
lights
the
are
wires.
On. Home.
No, yeah. The wires don't quite connect. Like, he delivered food, like Domino's. He was a pizza delivery guy, that kind of stuff. He claimed that he had fibromyalgia, mm-hmm. so he couldn't do a lot of things. He just seemed off. Mm-hmm. And then Shauna seems like a cold-hearted bitch with a black soul. There's just something off about her, too. She's icy, and it's just...
Well, and you know, we've talked about when these two people meet each mm-hmm. other, and maybe they mm-hmm. would have never... Had they met other people in their lives, that would have never occurred.
But, you know... If Dr. Cook said that she was suffocated by, or it seemed she had the, what looked like she was suffocated with a hand over her mouth,
mm-hmm.
that's not what Nathan said. Nathan said he did a chokehold on her.
Do you think Shauna did it?
So, yeah, I think they both went up there.
Why is she smiling? Like, who smiles?
Exactly. I mean, people can have weird...
I guess.
I mean,
like JonBenet's brother. He was that creepy smile. No offense, but
I mean, some people have, like, when I get nervous, I crack jokes all the time.
Crack jokes, but it's not, you do that with the nervousness, not your sibling was murdered.
Right.
I don't think you'd be cracking jokes then.
Oh, God, no. No, I don't know. Well, I hope I did that story justice for whomever.
Poor Becky. For Becky.
Requested this. And for Becky. But her, I'm telling you, the carriage was absolutely gorgeous. The horses, I mean, just the whole aspect of her future. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bawled. Darren, and his book is called Evil Within. You can get it on Amazon. It's Kindle edition, too. And I'm, like, reading all the funeral, and I'm just bawling the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then the grandpa singing, recording the version of Somewhere from West Side Story. I lost it. Completely lost it. And my husband's like looking at me like I'm crazy.
You just have to be there. You just gotta know, right?
And then he sang Somewhere. And he's like, hey, I don't know that song. And I'm like, not Bette Midler. You know, and I'm trying to think. Barbra Streisand did this version. Oh my God, you gotta hear it. And I'm like, yeah.
Terrible. So, terrible. Tear nuts. Well, mm-hmm. you did a good job, Jen.
All righty.
For Becky.
Thanks.
Terrible.
16. And another thing that was really hard, there's pictures in the back of the book. And as I
say, don't look at the pictures. Don't. Because then you.
I know.
This is what you need to say this, though. You do.
As I was looking through the back of the book, there was pictures. Becky's a beautiful young lady, as they all are. But they had a picture of when she was younger. And it stopped me in my tracks because she looked identical to my daughter when my daughter was the same age. In fact, when I showed my daughter goes, hey, is that me or you? My daughter thought it was her. And then when I showed my husband, he's like, oh, I've never seen that picture of Harper before. I'm like, that's because it's not Harper.
Yeah, it did. You showed me and I was like, holy moly.
I mean, they don't look anything alike now, but I was floored.
Yeah, it was shocking, I must say. Yes,
very shocking. But anyway, I hope the family is healing as best they could, and my heart goes out to them. I can't imagine.
As does mine. I don't know how anybody can live through that.
Bounce back.
Yeah, no way.
Alrighty. So that's it for this week's, the first week of November.
Ugh, can't believe it. The year's almost gone. 2021. I know. Every year really does go by faster. Let me tell you.
It does. I'm okay for this year to be over. So
I don't know. It can go. We'll see. I'm just getting older, so I don't like that.
On to bigger and better things for next year.
I hope.
But we'll talk about that later.
That's right. But until then, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, @JenNewsJen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.